What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s.
Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects.
With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last. Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com.
All medications require eligibility and prescription. First month as low as $25 with a 12-month MedPlus plan. Does not include the cost of GLP-1 medications.
Hello and welcome to The Katie Helper Show. Please rate and review and subscribe to The Katie Helper Show. And please become Patreon members at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. This is a special free bonus episode, and it includes an interview we did with Kristen Godsey, the author of Why Women Have Better Sex Under Socialism. And we're releasing it today because it's International Women's Day, and what better way to celebrate that holiday than by talking to someone who's written about that issue. As you'll see, the interview that we recorded with Kristen is from Valentine's Day, but it's just as relevant now as it was then. Kristen Argotsi is a professor of Russian and East European Studies and a member of the graduate group in anthropology at the University of Pennsylvania. She's an award-winning ethnographer and author specializing in the lived experience of socialism and post-socialism in Eastern Europe. She has written 9 books, and her scores of articles and essays have been translated into over a dozen languages and have appeared in publications such as Foreign Affairs, Jacobin, The World Policy Journal, The New Republic, Ms. Magazine, The Washington Post, The Lancet, and The New York Times. Her books include The Red Riviera, Gender, Tourism, and Post-Socialism on the Black Sea, The Left Side of History, World War II, and the Unfulfilled Promise of Communism in Eastern Europe, Red Hangover, Legacies of 20th Century Communism, and her most recent book, Why Women Have Better Sex Under Socialism and Other Arguments for Economic Independence. You can find out more about her at KristenGodsey.com. And you can also listen to her podcast, AK47, Selections from the Works of Alexandra Kollontai. And my co-host on this episode is Jack Allison, the host of Jack AM on Twitch. Hello.
Hi, Kristen. How are you?
Good, you?
Hi. I'm okay.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day.
And I wanted to just take this opportunity to ask you about, the premise of your book, of course, but also get into a discussion about like how the commodification of love and sex and desire relates to Valentine's Day.
Sure. Yeah.
So, yeah, we could start, though, with why did you write? I mean, you've written several books, but why did you write this book about sex under socialism?
Yeah. So this book kind of happened. I know that sounds really weird. It kind of happened by mistake. So right. what there's a weird story that has to do with a 2006-2007 documentary film that was made by a German filmmaker called, in English, Do Communists Have Better Sex? That was literally the name of the documentary film. And I was a visiting professor and fellow at the Freiburg Institute for Advanced Studies in Germany in 2014-2015. And they have this after hours series where German academics are wonderfully like relaxed. They sit around and drink wine. Right. And then like somebody gets up and like talks about something kind of interesting and hopefully a little controversial.
Right.
And then we just have a conversation. So I was asked, because I do, you know, I have this interest in Eastern Europe, and I also do gender stuff, and I've been doing research in the region for more than 20 years to sort of show some clips and discuss this film. So the problem, of course, about this was that most of the members of the audience were West German men. And this film essentially makes the argument, more or less, that like East German women had better sex, and that by extension, that means that East German men, I guess, are better in bed, right?
Right.
So anyway, it was so terribly uncomfortable for me to stand up in this thing and make this conversation. So I ultimately wrote a little essay about that experience, talking about Cold War memory and why we have these negative ideas about communism. And then that essay appeared in this book, Red Hangover, Legacies of 20th Century Communism, which was supposed to come out for the centennial of the Bolshevik Revolution in October of 2017. And right before the book was coming out, at the same time, the New York Times was doing a series called the Red Century series. And it was a series of essays reflecting on the centenary of the Bolshevik Revolution. And so, you know, they got in touch with the people at Duke University, but I don't exactly know what happened. And they asked for an excerpt of this chapter, if I could write an essay that sort of summarized some of the key arguments of that chapter. Anyway, wow, that blew up in my face.
Wow,
in a huge way. I was really, you know, I'd never written for the New York Times before. And I was really just sort of like, okay, I'm just going to send off this column and whatever. I've been toiling away in relative obscurity for a long time doing this like weird boutique research on women's rights in Eastern Europe. And anyway, so about a month after the op-ed came out, I got a call from a publisher in New York who said like, hey, do you think you could expand this argument into a book? And of course, I wasn't really keen to do it, except for that a lot of my academic colleagues and, you know, quite a lot of people who were just sort of hating on the op-ed basically said that in my 1,000 words, I had not fully substantiated all of the claims that I made in the argument. So the idea for the book was that I sort of made a deal with the publisher. I said, okay, they really wanted the title. I was a little more dubious about the title because I feel like it's kind of clickbaity. And but the exchange was that I got an unlimited number of endnotes to actually put in the studies that I'm referring to, all of these studies that were done on not only women's rights in Eastern Europe, women's issues, but also sexology and relative sexual satisfaction between East and West before and after the fall of the Berlin Wall. So it sort of blew up in my face, but it was a wonderful kind of opportunity for me to kind of look back at 20 years of research that I've been doing in the region on like, what did these East European countries do differently so that they had these very different outcomes when it came to not only women's economic independence, which is the subtitle of the book, but also, you know, women's personal and romantic satisfaction.
Yeah. And so you basically, the barter was that like you were able to give it a clickbaity title, but then like really nerd out on the actual like documentation.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, cause that was the, you know, it's a, I've published lots of books before and I've always published with academic presses. And so it was an interesting experience to sort of work with like a marketing team and how they were going to position the book and all that kind of stuff that happens, as you say, in this capitalist system that we live in.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, they really wanted...
That was Bodhi.
That was Bodhi. Was the dog, yeah.
Yes. Quoting yes, Amanda Wallerstein.
That was,
but yes,
right,
thank
that
you.
Was the
thank
dog,
you for
yes.
Yeah, elevating her voice. Yeah.
But yeah, I think that, you know, well, because of course, when you write an op-ed for the New York Times, you never get to choose your title. You don't even know what your title is until it appears in print, right? So that was the title that the New York Times gave it. And then that they wanted to keep, the publisher wanted to keep that title so that, you know, I don't know, people would remember they liked the title or whatever. So yeah, the idea was I sort of fought back with a little bit and then I couldn't come up with anything that was quite as catchy.
Towards an interrogation.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
I'm trying to think of what it would have been. Yeah.
Right. You know, it would have not at all sounded as, you know, so what I think is really fun about the book, especially because of the, you know, various people that I've talked to, people who have read it and will say, God, I thought this was going to be like a really light read. And then they pick up the book and it's like study after study after study after study with all these footnotes. And that was the other thing that I argued with them about was that I had footnotes sprinkled throughout and they wanted me for every paragraph to have one note at the end of the paragraph with all of the citations. So that was another compromise that I had to make. But I think that was okay because if you see the book, right, the I think it's like 200 pages or something like that.
Yeah, I'm opening it up.
20 pages of it is endnotes.
What's the best, which is always fun when you're reading something and you get, you realize it's shorter than you think, even when it's a great book like this, but what's the best website for me to open the like, obviously it's there's an Amazon, but it's Nation, is it Nation Books at first, or was it?
Yeah, it was originally Nation Books. Now it's changed its name to Bold Type Books.
Okay. So let me just, that's probably the best way to do it, right?
Yeah.
That's the link on your website. I should actually go through your website.
I think so.
Yeah. Let's see. Okay, so, sorry, I just wanted to, I got distracted because I want to show people, because the book cover is really, really cool. And who chose that?
They did, of course.
They did, okay.
Of course, yeah. I mean, it's really fun. There are various different iterations of the book cover. The original version, that was an interesting.
I know. And when you keep saying it blew up in my face, I'm like, oh, okay.
I know, yeah. It's Valentine's Day, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so the original is this. It's not this one. This is the Russian version. It's this woman with the javelin.
Right.
But then when they reissued the paperback, they did it with like a very subtle rose. Yeah, that's the original.
Yeah, I like this. Okay.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, and then the one below that is the British cover, which is similar, but a little bit, you know, more subtle, I suppose.
Yeah.
Less boldly Soviet. Yeah. Then those are the other things. But yeah, but like different, you know, this is the Czech one, which is just a simple kind of flower.
Let me stop sharing so that I can see. Can I see that one?
Yeah.
The Czech. Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
It has like an American Beauty vibe to it.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, and the lots of different foreign publishers have reinterpreted the cover in different ways. So it's been really fun to see that as well.
Yeah. And so what did you discover in your research, and how much of your research did you already have before working on the book? And how much did you then do once you were asked to write this book?
Yeah. So, you know, I literally have been teaching a class at university called Sex and Socialism since the fall of 2002.
Wow.
So 18 years.
Yeah.
So so multiple generations of undergraduate students have gone through this undergraduate class that I teach, which is sort of an introduction to, you know, the broader leftist ideas, because I actually start pre-Marx. I start with the utopian socialist, and I go all the way, you know, to people like Kollontai and then into the 20th century. But I actually had most of the material pretty much at my fingertips because I've been teaching, you know, I just basically had to go through my lecture notes and figure out what I wanted to include. I did spend a lot of time trying to update things and doing a lot of research on the Scandinavian countries because I thought the Scandinavian countries were a really good comparator. And then some of the more very specific sexological surveys. I'm not 100%, like I'm not a sexologist. I have colleagues in Eastern Europe who study sexology, anthropologists and sociologists who study sexology and East European sexology. So I was able to rely very heavily on their research and the research of other colleagues in Eastern Europe. But I wrote the book pretty quickly once it happened. It took me a while to decide to do it. But once I decided to do it, I basically just sort of sat down and kind of focused and gathered up all of this material and just sort of put it together. And you know, they also had a very strict word limit. So I couldn't really, you know, write the definitive tome on everything you ever wanted to know about East European sexuality and women's rights.
Was that liberating in a weird way? Because I feel like as an academic, there's like so much pressure and expectation and desire to be as thorough and as possible. And then you kind of can't be.
Yeah.
With a book like this, right? For this audience.
Exactly. And, you know, it was hard. I will say that it was my first real attempt to just write a straight non-specialist book where, you know, I'm sitting there and explaining really sort of basic things that I think are, you know, that other people should know, but they not necessarily, you know, the thing about teaching university is that like I keep getting older, but my students remain 18 to 22.
Right.
And every year I teach them, I think, how do you not know this already? I've been teaching this for 18 years. Right. So it was a challenge, but you're right. I think it was strangely liberating in the sense that I just had to be succinct. I had to make an argument, or I had already made the argument. I needed to substantiate the argument with all of the empirical evidence that I could muster. And I had to do that without getting distracted by, oh, let me tell you about this other really interesting thing on the side.
Yeah. And so what are the most important things that you think people need to know that, you know, they'll obviously learn about in more detail in your book. But what are the things that surprise you that because they're not more, they're not as much part of common knowledge as you'd think?
Right. So I think the one thing that especially, and I speak very specifically about the United States, because right. the Europeans have a little bit better sense of the variety. But in the United States, we have a very narrow understanding of what communism was in the 20th century in Eastern Europe. And people tend to reduce that entire experience, you know, which is from like Albania all the way up to the Baltics and across from, you know, Budapest all the way to Vladivostok. This is huge area over a long period of time in the Soviet Union, almost 70 years, and then 40, 45 years in Eastern Europe. They tend to reduce everything to the 30s and Stalin and the gulags and the right. famines. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, one of the things that I really try to do in the book is say, look, that is such a reductive view. We need to really look at all of this different nuance. There were different policies, different styles of socialism that was that were being practiced in Eastern Europe. You had self-managing socialism in Yugoslavia. You had what they called goulash communism in Hungary. The Soviet Union, you know, before Stalin took power, was very liberal and then became really conservative. And then after Stalin died, there was de-Stalinization. It became quite liberal again in certain ways. Romania was awful. Albania was awful. So the first thing I want people to know is that this is a very diverse region. The second thing people don't realize is how nostalgic many people are for Eastern European state socialism in this part of the world to this day, even 30 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall or the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. So, and then the big question is, well, why? What's going on?
And, right. you know, and you're talking about the people who experienced it.
The people who lived under it. Yeah. yeah. And not only the people who lived under it, which I think is real. This to me, this is, you know, something that I study. Is there's a kind of vicarious nostalgia for people who were born after 89, right. but who had parents who grew up, you know, they look at their old family photo albums or their home movies from their grandparents or parents' days, and they're like, wow, this actually doesn't look as bad as everybody's telling us it was. Now, there were like really lots of negative things. I'm not trying to whitewash that sure. at all, mm-hmm. but it is interesting that there's this persistence of nostalgia. And so when you start to scratch at the surface of, well, why are people nostalgic? One of the things that you hear over and over and over again is that people say our relationships were more authentic. Mm. Our lives were less commodified. We were less stressed. We were less harried. We, you know, had more free time. We had, you know, more affective resources to share with the people in our lives, even among our colleagues, even when we were at work. And that's something that, like, capitalism, when it came, it like obliterated this so profoundly. And so as a social scientist, one of the things that I do and that social scientists do when they want to look at how to compare two economic systems and the impacts that they have on people's lives, because people were writing about the fact that capitalism was bad for our love lives way back in the middle of the 19th century. And so right. the question is how do we do an empirical test? Well, we look for a natural experiment. And it turns out that you know, Germany was one country in 1945, and then it got divided, and mm-hmm. pretty much one side was capitalist, one side was communist. There were other, you know, differences, but for the most part, they're the same. And they're divided for 40 years by this, 45 years by this ideology, and then they come back together. Let's look at the differences. And that's what's so fascinating about the research that we have, is that it really does show that, again, you know, using largely self-reported data, but consistently studies that have been done both before and after 89 show that people show higher levels of satisfaction and contentment and joy in their personal lives in the East compared to the West.
And I thought that one of the most interesting parts of this is that you talk about how the end of the Cold War also had negative effects for the West in general, because the gains around women's rights, around employment, education that were achieved by the socialist or communist governments pressured the United States into doing that. And we saw that a lot with the civil rights movements, right? So
yes.
it was like embarrassing the United States into being better on issues of racism. Can you talk about how that played out in gender?
So Mary Dudziak has this wonderful book called Cold War Civil Rights, which precisely talks about the Cold War context of the U.S. civil rights movement. And the book that I published in 2019, it's called Second World, Second Sex. And it does a sort of similar thing for the women's movement. So like very specifically, until 1957, Western male leaders largely thought of women's emancipation and arguments for women's emancipation as a communist front, right? So that communist appeal to women by convincing them that they would be happier if they could work outside the home or whatever. And so there was a, you know, there's a wonderful book by Elaine Tyler May called Homeward Bound, which really talks about the kind of traditional American family as a Cold War artifact, especially in the 50s. But then in 1957, with the launch of the first Sputnik satellite, the American government goes, how the hell did they do that? Right? I mean, it's just a metal ball around the earth that's beeping, right? But it scared it scared people a lot. And one of the immediate paranoias that the American government had was that the Soviets were using women, that they had double the number of scientists, double the number of scientific geniuses, because they were identifying girls and giving them scientific education at an early age. So in 1958, the United States government passes the National Defense Education Act. And that is a piece of legislation that specifically earmarks money for the education of girls in math and science and engineering. Title IX, the legislation that we have that allows, you know, that gives federal dollars for girls and women's sports, is also a reaction to the fact that the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc countries kept beating the United States at the Olympic medal count because of women's sports. We didn't have enough female athletes to compete against these amazing Soviet women who kept just like clearing the decks of the gold medals. So I can give you a lot of other examples. 1961, the first Presidential Commission on the Status of Women, which was signed by Executive Order 10980, I believe, by John F. Kennedy. In the preamble of that executive order, Kennedy cites national security as a reason why we need to think about women's rights. So we were scared. There was a fear that if the Soviets mobilized their women into the labor force and they were able to use women's intelligence. Another great example, if you guys have been watching The Queen's Gambit, is Soviet women's chess.
Yeah.
In the international realm, the Soviet women were amazing at chess. They just couldn't be beaten. So there are all sorts of ways in which, to the extent that American men in particular, but I would say a sort of brand of conservative 50s, because obviously this wouldn't be true of people who are affiliated with the left, right? Like, you know, the CPUSA, all these people who are purged by Hawke and McCarthy. Right. But the kind of conservative traditional Americans for a long time argued that women just were naturally not good at things like math or science, or they weren't naturally competitive enough to be athletes, or they were naturally not X or naturally not Y. And then when the Soviet Union actually did it, either you had to argue, and by the way, some of them did, that Soviet women weren't really women. there's something unique about what was going over there. Or you had to admit that maybe women could be really good mathematicians or chess players or athletes.
And it's kind of like the options there are that we were wrong, or they can be really good at that. It sucks for women and womanhood and our definitions, but it's worth it because of national security to overcome, you know.
Exactly.
To embrace this unnatural.
This unnatural thing, which is women working outside the home and in male professions,
And can you talk about some of the sex studies in terms of satisfaction and, you know, what the studies that you cite, which support the claim that sex is better in socialist countries for women?
Okay, so the studies that are specifically cited in the book are a series of studies that were done, the first in 1988, so prior to the fall of the Berlin Wall, by a sexologist in East Germany called Kurt Stark and his colleagues. And then they, because of the results, they were replicated after 89. So the first thing I want to say is that there's always a problem with self-reported data. So obviously people are answering these questions. And one of the critiques of these studies is that the women who were living under communism didn't answer truthfully or whatever.
All right. Yeah.
But after 89, they were free to answer as they wanted. And there were similar results. The study was done over and over again in a variety of different ways. So the actual numbers are fascinating. So the two proxy questions for sexual satisfaction. The first is, the last time when you had sex, were you happy? And, you know, did you feel happy? And, you know, so this is kind of a weird, you know, a weird way of saying, was it good or not? And I don't have that number right in front of me. But the other, which I'll find it in a sec. Oh, yeah, yeah, here it is. GDR women. So the last time you had sex, were you happy? So GDR women said that 82% of the time, the last sexual encounter that they had, they were happy. Compared to women in the West, so this would be the FRG, the West Germans, only 52% said they were happy.
Discrepancy, yeah.
That's a huge discrepancy, okay? Mm-hmm. And then they get a little bit deeper into, again, these double entendres, yeah. Yeah, so to speak. So the second way they ask the question is, did your last sexual encounter leave you feeling satisfied? That's how they ask the question. And here, 74% of West German men said yes, and 75% of East German men said yes. So not a big difference on the men. But look at the difference on the women. 84% of, oh, wait, hold on. I got to redo that. Oh. So GDR women, 75% said yes. GDR men, 74% said yes. So about equal.
Sure.
But with West German men, it's 84% of men said, yeah, I was satisfied after my last sexual encounter, but only 46% of West German women. So that's less than half of West German women compared to 75% of East German women. So this sort of shows you that there's something going on. But the other thing that I think is really interesting is preferences for marriage. So let's say you're dating, you're on the market, whatever, and you're having, you know, partners. What percentage of the people that you're dating or that you might date, and of course, this is all heterosexual data that bears, you know, these studies focus specifically on opposite sex couples. So in the East of Germany, the communist part of Germany, 73% of women and 74% of men said that they were interested in getting married. Like if they found the right person, they would be cool with that, right? Whereas in the Western part, the capitalist part of Germany, 71% of women said that they would be interested in getting married, but only 57% of men.
Wow. Hmm.
So, you know, you have these really interesting discrepancies, which means that there's something there that is making not the actual experience, but the way you reflect on that experience, if we're talking about self-reported data, significantly different in the East that is socialist compared to the West that is capitalist. And so what I tried to do in the book is to try to tease out what exactly was going on in that data. And it's not only Germany. So I have a colleague, Katarzyna Liszkova, who just wrote a book called Sexual Revolution, Socialist Style, which is all about the sexual revolution in Czechoslovakia before 1968. And then I have another colleague, Agnieszka Korzyanska, who's Polish. She's also an anthropologist. And she writes a really wonderful book that's just come out in English about Polish sexology and how Polish socialist era sexologists treated sexual, what we call dysfunctions, very differently than they were treated in the West. And in some ways, she makes this argument that the Polish sexologists were way more progressive than in the capitalist West.
Okay. And what does that do to?
Yeah. Okay. So so we tend in the West to think of sexuality as an individualized thing, right? And this comes in large part from Masters and Johnson and the sort of standard four-stage sexual response theory, which ultimately is all about the right kinds of stimulation. It's like about technique, and it lends itself to pharmaceuticalization very easily.
Right.
And so if you have an issue, like there's got to be a pill somewhere for it. Whereas in the socialist East, and particularly in Poland, where she did all of this really interesting research, she actually herself went through the training to become a sexologist. They think of sex and sexuality and intimate relations as being embedded in social relations.
Right.
And so in a larger political economy. So if you have an issue in your personal life, it's not just about you or your partner. It's about the society that you're living in and whether or not that society is a healthy society. And so that's a very different way of thinking about people's intimate lives. And what that means is that if you're a sexologist, you not only have to study you know, medicine and psychiatry or psychology, but you also have to know a little bit of philosophy, a little sociology, a little anthropology. Interestingly, because Poland was Catholic, a little theology. So they were more well-rounded, and they really thought, like, look, if people are exhausted and unhappy, and if they are worried about the future and paying their bills or whatever, like, who's going to be happy? Like, the world doesn't stop at your bedroom door. So you have to really think about people as embedded in a wider net of social relations rather than just individual units that you're treating in a very particular pharmaceutical way.
And so why are men, I mean, why is there such a discrepancy between men and women in the West in a way that there isn't in the East? And what does that tell us about the effects of capitalism on relationships? I'm just grabbing one thing I dropped. Sorry.
Yeah. So this is a really interesting conversation to have on Valentine's Day, obviously, because I think that the big difference, again, as and this has been discussed for a long time in socialist theory, going back to people like Flora Tristan and August Bebel in Germany and Clara Zetkin and Alexander Kollontai and even Friedrich Engels to a certain extent, is that under capitalism, women are, and women's sexuality, are commodities. And increasingly, like in late capitalism, where I would say we are now, our affections, our attentions, and our emotions are also being commodified in really extreme ways. And so the argument has always been that under socialism, when people are, like, the value of your personhood doesn't have a monetary sign attached to it, you're going to relate to people in a very different way. And the ethnographic research around things like friendships and just wider social relations really bears this out, that after 89, people really feel that, you know, everybody is hustling and nobody has time for anybody anymore. And there's this competitiveness and it's sort of a zero-sum dog-eat-dog world. And of course, you also have massive out-migration in this part of the world. There are all sorts of sort of social and structural problems that we could talk about. But I think it's really interesting that, like, for instance, they didn't have Valentine's Day in the Soviet Union. It comes to Russia in the 90s, and it's a super hyper-commodified version of respecting or, like, paying attention to your loved ones rather than what they used to celebrate, which was sort of International Women's Day, right, on March 8th. Yeah.
Right.
Where you would buy women flowers and chocolates, but it wasn't just your lovers. It was your colleagues. It was your mother. It was your female friends. It was a much wider appreciation of just society-wide for women than just, like, this person that you were either romantically involved with or want to be romantically involved with. And I think that the discrepancy between why it is that West German men don't want to get married as much as West German women is that it's an economic relationship in West Germany. And so West German men know that they're going to have to support these women, and women know that they're going to be supported. So there's an imbalance. Whereas in the East, you can see that everybody sort of has they've come to the relationship with their own sort of level of social security. So marriage is something that you want to do because you want to spend time with that person. Right. You want to formalize that relationship, not because you actually want an economic relationship out of this person.
Right. And it really lets people's individual psychological, personal baggage run the show instead of just financial, you know, economic needs, which is a nice thing also. I'm just kidding. Kind of. But, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I was saying this the other day, I think, on the stream that, you know, as I of course, I love the idea of men, of women and men, like, sharing drink, you know, footing the bill, going Dutch or whatever. But I'm fine with a man paying for my drinks or dinner because it's reparations, because we live in the system where women make less money. But I could imagine that could be, I'm just trying, I have something in my head now that's like, comedic sketch that I have not sketched out, but something where someone constantly uses socioeconomic stuff to be like, to get away with things. Yeah. But I don't think that's a real problem. But and what was the most surprising thing that you found? Like, was anything not what you kind of thought it would be in your research?
I mean, so the really surprising thing to me was the discovery of sexual economics theory and how the conservatives in this country have used that. So I was aware of all of these sort of 19th century and early 20th century socialist texts talking about heterosexual courtship as a monetary exchange or as a market transaction. What I was not expecting was to find a paper published, I think, in 2002 or 2003 by these two, I believe they're social psychologists, talking about sex as an economic exchange, right? And the way that that market works in the United States. And so they were basically admitting that under capitalism, this is actually how it works.
Right.
You know, they didn't realize that they were like basically being, so, you know, 19th century socialists. They were quite seriously just talking about, you know, the way that markets work and how if, you know, and then they have this really weird argument about the, you know, the price of sex. So they actually go and they say, okay, so in societies where women have a lot of economic independence, so Scandinavia are the perfect examples of this, right? Then women, they say the price of sex is low, right? So women can basically have partners and their economic situation is not dependent on those partners, right? So they basically tend to choose their partners on the basis of love and attraction and mutual affection or whatever. And they also, you know, they tend to, there's people have more sex, right? Whereas in societies where women have no educational opportunities or professional opportunities, no rights whatsoever, then the price of sex is really high. It's marriage. Like basically you can't have sex with a woman unless you marry her because it's like her most valuable asset, right?
Right.
And so they actually do that. They go and they get this like independent sex survey. And then they also try to correlate that with a measure of gender equality. And they basically come up with this argument that says in societies where women have more economic independence, then, you know, sexual cultures are more liberal and people are, you know, generally a lot less uptight about this. Whereas in societies where women have no rights whatsoever or no birth control or no access to abortion, then the price of sex is really high because if you get pregnant, you're stuck with caring for the baby and you need a man to support you. So weirdly, conservatives in this country have taken that as an argument for getting rid of abortion and contraception and making sure that women don't have rights so that we can go back to having like a 1950s Leave It to Beaver kind of happy family. Yeah. And that to me, like, because all of my research is in Eastern Europe, I never really thought about the American side of things. And so that was really surprising to me. I shouldn't have been really surprising, but it was just surprising to me how unaware these Americans were of this much longer socialist history around these questions, and that they were essentially just admitting that, yeah, under capitalism, right, sex is going to be a commodity. Whereas if you live in a society with lots of social safety nets, then sex becomes less valuable as a commodity because women have other opportunities to actually pay their rent and their bills.
Yeah, it reminds me of, I remember, you know, Bernie Sanders explaining one of the many, obviously healthcare is a human right, but he would always say that, you know, if you have healthcare, you don't have to stick with a job that you don't like just because you have insurance. Just because it gives you healthcare, you know, health insurance, and if you quit it, you'll be, you know, vulnerable to illness and death. So it's similar with, right, like you'll stay in a job, you'll stay in a relationship.
Yeah, I mean, the Kaiser Family Foundation did a study, and for women 64 and under in this country, you know, obviously you get 65, you get Medicare, but if you don't have Medicare yet, I think a quarter of American women get access to health insurance through their spouse.
Yeah.
One in four. So that means that if you are in a relationship that is abusive, you know, or unhappy or somehow otherwise unsatisfying, and you need access to medical care, you can't leave that person unless you want to go out and, you know, buy insurance on the exchange, which we all know is very expensive. So, it's a real trap for people, not to mention that a lot of people literally get married for health insurance, in this country. Whereas in other countries where, you know, just by virtue of you being a citizen, you get access to a doctor, medical care, if you need it, that actually gives you a lot more personal freedom. And that's the other thing, like with people, you know, people who are kind of haters of the idea of any kind of expanded social safety nets, they always make this argument that it's going to reduce liberty or reduce freedom.
Right.
But if you take 5 seconds and you think about it, right, you're not trapped in your job. You're not trapped in your relationship if you have portable health insurance that follows you wherever you go. How is that reducing your liberty? It's weird. It's a weird argument.
Yeah. What do they mean? I mean, it's kind of embarrassing. But now that you framed it that way, I'm like, wait, what are they even claiming? It's because what, taxes make you not free?
Taxes make you not free. There's a fear that you will have fewer choices of providers, that there'll be death They make all of these really complicated arguments that for those of us that are lucky enough to have employer-based healthcare that is decent, right, that it'll be gone and we'll have to wait in like Soviet-style bread lines in order to see a doctor. That's the fear-mongering that comes back to what I was talking about at the beginning of the show, or beginning of our interview, about how people have this stereotype of the Cold War,
right?
In fact, you know, right now I'm teaching a class on population and public health in Eastern Europe. At the University of Pennsylvania, and we're talking about the old Semashko system, which was the old universal healthcare system in these Eastern Bloc countries, and then what happened after 89 when they decided to go more commercial. You know, and for my students, this is like a huge eye opener for them because they just never quite realized. You know, they've just read a paper that was done by the London School of Tropical Hygiene, like a very legitimate place, that looked at all these healthcare reforms in Southeastern Europe. And they said, you know, actually, it turns out that people were probably better off with their old communist healthcare system than they are with what came afterwards.
Yeah.
And that's a shocker to a lot of people, just in terms of health outcomes, right? We're not talking about ideology. We're just talking about actually, you know, getting people to see doctors and be treated for illnesses that they have.
Right. And what is your, I mean, a lot of what you discuss in the book is kind of, you kind of undo myths about the Cold War, about communism, about the way, you know, how people don't understand the diversity among the kind of leftist, you know, from Stalinist to Scandinavia, that whole, if you want to call it that, that whole spectrum. So what are the things that you think people really need to know about this legacy? Like, what are the biggest myths that you think need to be busted?
Yeah, well, I mean, so the first thing I want to say, right, is that I think, you know, many people, when they hear about the Holodomor or the purges or the Gulag, you know, sometimes there's this knee-jerk reaction that, oh, that's just anti-communism. And that's not the right reaction. Those things happened, right? We should not deny the crimes and the atrocities that were committed in this part of the world. So the first thing is that there's obviously some truth. There were consumer shortages. There were travel restrictions. You did have the secret police. All of those things are real.
Right.
However, the biggest problem that we have is, what about the things that were actually positive?
Right.
And there were some. And what happens, I think, is, you know, Daniel Kahneman talks a lot about system one, system two thinking and how we don't like nuance. Nuance confuses us. And we really need to have nuance when we talk about the 20th century experience of Eastern European state socialism, because a lot of people who lived that are still alive. And first of all, as an ethnographer, I talk to these people and they tell me, you know, it really wasn't that bad. Mm. So either they have complete false consciousness or they've been brainwashed or something. But I have to listen to what they say because that's my job. But the second thing is, you know, we can actually look empirically at outcomes. We can look at, you know, certain kinds of indicators about life expectancy. So just to give you an example of a really concrete number that I was just talking to somebody about recently, I think in 1910, before the First World War, average Russian life expectancy was 33 years old. Compared to France, and it was like 49, okay? And so that's a really low, like you died when you were 33 at the average, right? If you were born in 1910 in Tsarist Russia. By 1970, the average life expectancy in the Soviet Union was 68, and in France it was 71. So the Soviets, despite everything that was wrong with their country, managed to close the life expectancy gap with France to within 3 years, right? From a 16-year gap to a 3-year gap in 60 years, right? That's pretty impressive, not to mention the industrialization. You know, so again, I don't want to paper over the problems, but when we look at things like women's rights, when we look at athletics, when we look at chess, when we look at music or the performing arts, when we look at literature, there are a lot of things that came out of the East, and that's independent, okay, of speaking about the effect that having a real ideological enemy on the world stage. I heard you mention Wallerstein earlier, world systems theory, right? So if you have an ideological enemy, it puts pressure on Western governments to kind of, you know, step up for their workers and their women and their minority populations in a way that they don't have to if there's no ideological threat. So I'm saying independent of the Cold War impacts, there were actual things that they got right. So when I write about this part of the world, what I want people to know is like, you look, we can get rid of the bad things and keep the good things, like the polyclinic system, right? There were things that worked really well and we could adapt them and repurpose them because we are facing challenges today in the 21st century, like the pandemic, for instance, but also climate change and possibility of automation and extreme inequality, all problems that the market cannot solve. So if the market cannot solve it, we need to have alternative discourses. And the last thing I want to say is I think that the experiences of 20th century state socialism in Eastern Europe are often used as a cudgel to shut down social dreaming in the West. Right. So people just say, well, if we have universal healthcare, we're all going to end up in the gulags, right? It's a slippery slope to the famines and the purges. Right. And that's where I think it's really important to push back. And I don't think we have to whitewash the past. Yeah. That's a problem. But I do think we need to push back and we actually need to say that there were some good things that they did. And we recognized them during the Cold War. I can show you any number of American government reports, federal government reports, talking about the things that the Soviets were doing well and how we could improve and do them better. But in the last 30 years, we've kind of erased all of that nuance and just made it one big Stalinist hellish nightmare. And so it's very difficult to talk about. And I can tell you that it's very difficult to talk about.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you is like, so two final questions. One is what the takeaways are, how we can apply these things. And also like, given how, you know, how much anti-communism infiltrates, you know, everything, did you, like, even the fact that you're doing research like this, like, did you come from a left family? How did you arrive at this place where you're actually looking at things like this without condemning them?
It's kind of embarrassing.
This is a safe space.
I was a model United Nations dork in high school. And I mean, I was like, very serious about model United Nations. And this was in the 80s during the Reagan era. And when I, so if you're a model United Nations dork, like the thing that you want more than anything else is to win the gavel. And the best way to win the gavel is to be a country with veto power on the Security Council. So there are only five of those. And since my model United Nations club was mostly dominated by boys, if we got France, UK, or the US, they would always take those countries. And back then in the 80s, China was boring because they always abstained. So the only opportunity for me to ever get on the Security Council to win a gavel, which was like my little nerdy dream, was to be the Soviet Union. And so in the 1980s, it wasn't easy to find information about the Soviet Union. So I would go off to the library and read US News and World Report, and I would find Engels and Marx and try to read as much stuff as I could in the original. And so in the process of reading it so that I could better represent these countries and their foreign policy on, you know, a mock UN conference, I started to realize, wow, God, this isn't as crazy as I thought it was. A lot of this is actually making sense to me. And it was like this sort of slow slide into, oh my gosh, this is making a lot of sense to me. And it was really kind of a weird autodidactic issue. And then, you know, to be fair, I went to UC Santa Cruz then I went to UC Berkeley. Yeah, I got my PhD at Berkeley. So I was a public school kid and I, you know, ended up in Northern California where, guess what? There are a lot of lefty people. Right. And so I came into my politics, you know, pretty young, but then I was in Eastern Europe in June of 1990, right after the wall fell and before the Soviet Union had fallen. And I traveled throughout the region and I realized that this was like one of the most exciting places that I wanted to be. So when I went back to grad school to do my dissertation fieldwork in the later 90s, I think I first went to Bulgaria in 97 or 98. And then I did fieldwork in 99 and 2000. And that was like at that moment of the transition where it was like the wild, wild east. And so, And then I got married to a Bulgarian and I have a half Bulgarian daughter. And, you know, the story goes. But yeah, right. It's not a family background. In fact, I have very little. I have none. Zero, I think. No East European background whatsoever. Oh, yeah. I'm like Puerto Rican Persian. So it's like a bizarre mixture.
Wow, that's cool. Yeah. Puerto Rican Persian. Yeah. Have to come up with a food for that.
Yeah, not easy.
No, because there's pizza bagel that I made up, potato famine latke for my Irish Jewish friends.
Oh, there you go.
So Persian Puerto Rican, that's all right. We'll work on that.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Really, so maybe like some kind of like plantain kebab or something.
Yeah, plantain kebab. Yeah, I like that. Actually, and it sounds really good.
Yeah, it does.
What about in terms of politics? Is your family progressive, leftist, right wing, centrist, mixed, apolitical?
It's a long story.
Okay.
My grandmother, you know, has a third grade education. She's still alive. She's in her 90s. And she was a union. She was a garment worker in New York. And so she was a member of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union.
My great grandmother too. Yeah.
So she was like lefty, union lefty, but to the extent that, you know, she was a Catholic and she liked John F. Kennedy because he was a Catholic. And so, you know, she had like her political education comes out of a third grade education, right? She could basically read and write in Spanish, but you know, it was limited. And my mom is an even weirder case because she was raised by nuns until she was 14. And so her politics are just like, she's like liberal kind of left, but not really left.
Yeah.
My dad was a much more difficult case because he was sort of weirdly atheist and Muslim, and he had weird politics when he was younger. And yeah, I don't know. I can't really describe what they were. I don't think it actually came from my parents, but my dad was an immigrant. And so I was very aware of the rest of the world, which most young girls living in Southern California in the 80s weren't. So that was probably why I was such a major UN nerd. Because I came from this mixed background and, you know, I had Farsi and Spanish.
I was going to ask, do you speak Farsi and Spanish? Or?
No, but I had it like, you know, constantly around. Yeah. My parents wouldn't allow me to speak any foreign languages in the house because both of them had accents and they didn't want me to have an accent. So
what did they speak? English? Together. I mean, to each other.
Bad English.
Okay, yeah.
Really bad English, actually. My mom, you know, was kind of a New Yorker, so she had a really broad Brooklyn accent, and my dad was really hard to understand. They managed somehow to communicate, but there was also a big age difference between them. My mom got married when she was 18, and my dad was already, like, 29, so.
Oh, okay. Oh, but for back, I thought you were going to tell me, like, he was 40 or something.
No, wasn't such a huge age difference, still,
and even now,
you know, but it means that the generations on that side of my family are really, really short. Cause my grandmother also had my mom when she was 18. Right. Yeah. And I have a younger brother who had his first kid when he was 18 or 19. And now his kids have kids when they're like 18 or 19. So my grandmother is the matriarch of five generations.
Oh my gosh.
Now.
So she's a great, great, great grandmother or no, a great, great grandmother.
She's a great, great grandmother.
Wow. Yeah. That's really...
It's pretty crazy, right?
Yeah. I thought when you were saying short generations, I thought you were like generations of shorter people because
compacted generations. Yeah. In the sense that like when you have your kids really young...
Of course, yeah.
Then they, you know, the generations sort of stack up on top of each other. Yeah.
I come from the opposite because I come from a psychiatrist dad and a... novelist, feminist, mom, like basically Woody Allen plot. But my mom did grow up very working class. But yeah, they just me and not later in life, I guess, but in their 30s. I'll leave it at that. Which I guess when I was born was a little bit like in their milieu. And for you, I'm sure have the could access the ethnographic anthropological evidence. But it's an interesting range. But and anything else you want to make sure that we talk about? Anything you want to comment about, whether it's about communism and sex or socialism, sex, what is to be done, so to speak, or Valentine's Day?
Yeah, well, God, there's so much to say. I mean, you know, the one thing that I want to say is that, you know, Valentine's Day is this huge commercial holiday. And I think I sent you this National Retail Foundation report. $21.7 billion is what Americans are going to spend in 2021 on this holiday, which is, if you go to the World Bank website, I think there are like 70 countries that have a GDP of less than $20 billion a year.
Jeez.
So it's so obscenely commercial, right? I would say, You know, I mean, whatever. I mean, you know, you can just dump on holidays as much as you want. But if it's, on the other hand, it's the kind of time, if people, if it means something to people, then like, why take it away from them? I mean, whatever.
Like Santa. But, if you want to believe in Santa or romance, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. Right. You know, more power to you. But I would say that I think that, you know, one of the lessons of, for me anyway, of thinking about romance differently. So it's a lot of this comes back to this essay by this woman, Alexandra Kollontai, that I have this podcast about.
Oh, yeah.
Called Make Way for Winged Eros. And in that essay, it's freely available online. You can find it. And she does a Marxist analysis of love. She does a sort of dialectical materialist reading of love. And, it's a little challenging, but it's worth it. And it really sort of helps you understand that our definition of love is bound very intricately to the social and political relations within which we exist. And so, you know, the like sort of little soundbitey things that I would say is when we use words like, I'm going to spend some time with my significant other, we should say share. I'm going to share some time, right? When we say I'm investing in this relationship, that's like a really capitalist way of talking about our relationship. Mm-hmm. So we should say like, I'm going to nurture this relationship today, or I'm going to, you know, pay some attention to this relationship today.
When you break up— attention.
no, not pay. There you go. Another one. Yeah. Right. So nurture, it's hard to get rid of this language.
I know.
When you break up and you're going back out on the market. Think about word.
My gosh,
I'm on the market. Like I'm a good that I'm selling. Mm-hmm. So is there a way of saying like, I'm making myself available? I don't know. I mean, I just think we should think about the language that we use when we talk about romance. And to decommodify ourselves, right? Like, why think of ourselves as commodities? I mean, we have to do that during the day, right? We have to do that. And I've just been reading Sarah Jaffe's wonderful new book, Love, what is it called? Work Won't Love You Back.
Yeah.
Big plug for Sarah Jaffe's book. And, you know, she really says we have to know what work is. And I think she quotes Federici on this. We have to know what work is so that we can, you know, really love properly in our lives. I'm paraphrasing here. But I do think, you know, we should not allow the economic system within which we live to completely commodify our attention and our affections and our emotions. This is not a moral or normative judgment. Sure. I'm just saying if we can be cognizant of the moments when we're not in the market, like when we're going to bed at night or when we're taking a shower, you know, to the extent that we can remove ourselves from the market occasionally in this crazy world where the market is trying to penetrate into the market is trying to like seep into every single crevice of our lives. It's impossible to get away from this language. But like, we are not commodities. We are autonomous human beings, you know, independent, socially embedded, but valuable independent of our market worth. So in Marxism, there's this really wonderful distinction between use value and exchange value. And when I teach this concept to my students, I always tell them, you have use value independent of your exchange value. You are living in a society that wants you to think that you are your exchange value. And that is what is alienating you. And that is what is making you feel lonely and disconnected. But if you can stop for a second and understand, I mean, I hate using this kind of, you know, overtly Marxist jargon, but it's really important to understand the distinction between those two things, because you are not a commodity. You are a person. And yes, you're embedded in this wider social world that is, you know, commodified and commercialized in all sorts of ways, but you don't necessarily only exist within that milieu. You can pull yourself out, and we should think consciously about moments when we can. I know that it's not always easy, but I think that if we become collectively more aware of those moments, I think we will be happier. We will feel our lives less commercialized and less commodified.
Yeah. Great. Jack, any final questions from you?
This has been fascinating. Yeah. You know, it really has been good to talk to you. And yeah, this is what a fascinating whole thing. Life would be better. Life would be better if we could break out of this horrendous system someday.
Well, how are you going to apply this to your relationship, Jack?
Me and my relationship? I'm already embarrassed because I went and bought $20 flowers today, and I helped contribute to the GDP of a small nation being spent today.
Right.
So, you know, I think what I'm going to do after this is take the flowers, go throw them in the trash and tell my wife we can't be commodifying our relationship like this.
You should take a video of yourself burning the flower, the bouquet with a lighter and be like, I did this for you because I really care this, about you.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. And I know you're better Kate. Than
yeah,
you
no, no, are the not best a commodity. The best way to handle this is to say, you know, if it weren't for the pandemic, I would have, you know, gone out and picked these from a garden somewhere, sustainable, you know, contributing to the local economy, owned by a co-op or whatever.
Right.
But because of the evil pandemic and this evil system, I had to go out and actually buy them with hard currency.
Yeah.
And so it is not the ideal.
Damn pandemic. I wish I could be out there getting my hands all cut on flowers and shit. God damn it, I hate it.
One of the worst things about the pandemic is probably how it limits my flower picking abilities. Yeah. Well, this is great. And what are you working on next?
So I have a couple of projects. I am interested in the utopian ideologies around personal life. So actually going back and looking from Plato. Plato is really interesting. He's a kind of a proto-communist who really thought that his guardians should have collective property and have relationships in common with each other and their wives, right? A lot of people don't realize that Plato was pretty radical in this respect. And then like looking at books like the original book Utopia by Thomas More or Tommaso Campanella's City of the Sun, I'm really interested in sort of tracing utopian theories all the way to the utopian socialists, obviously in 19th century Europe, and then to the Soviet Union in the Eastern Bloc, but then also looking at sort of alternative hedonisms, Kate Sorper's new book, and different discussions, different futurisms, Afrofuturism. So all of these different discourses, often they tend to focus on changes that we can make in the public sphere. So things, that, you know, tweaks that we can do, like Aaron Vestani's, what is it, Fully Automated Luxury Communism? Yeah. I don't know if you've read that book. He talks about like solar power and asteroid mining and all these things. Or Rutger Bregman's book, Utopia for Realists. They're tweaks that we can make in the public sphere. And I'm really interested in the history of utopian theories as they were applied to the private sphere. Because that's a big story that very few people really think about, is that there are these other narratives and discourses that are out there. So that's one thing. And the other thing that I'm really interested in is girls and science and socialism. So to the extent that we have really wonderful empirical evidence that girls in the Eastern Bloc have a less of a gap with boys on standardized mathematics tests, and that there are a lot more engineers and scientists in the East. Like, how did they manage to overcome these gender stereotypes? Like, what was it about socialist education in sciences and engineering and technology that allow, even 30 years after the fall, a new generation of women to go into these fields that are still so incredibly heavily masculinized in the United States?
Right.
That, to me, is a really interesting question. So those are kind of two things that I'm thinking about a lot these days.
And just remind people where they can find your podcast, what the podcast is. And also, someone wants to know the name of the book you recommended, but you recommended a couple. So I
don't know which one. Yeah, but maybe Sarah Jaffe's book was the specific book recommendation. Yeah. It's called Work Won't Love You Back. It just came out. It's a really interesting read, sort of thinking about work and the kind of hegemony of capitalism teaching us that we have to love our jobs, even though we're being exploited. It's a really thought out argument. So the podcast is called AK-47, which is Alexander Kollontai, 47 works of hers. And I read them and I discuss them. I mean, it's sort of a nerdy thing. It's a kind of very text-based thing, but it's fun. We have good discussions about like how we can apply some of these early socialist feminist writings to the 21st century. And that's at ak47.buzzsprout.com. My books, if you go to my website, you can see it there. All my books are listed on the website and you can, you know, most of them are academic, but there are a couple that are less academic and that are more accessible to general audiences. Red Hangover is a series of essays reflecting on these, the sort of last 20, 30 years of legacies of communism. And then obviously why women have better sex under socialism and other arguments for economic independence.
Right. Great. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Come back.
Yes, it was fun. This was really fun. Yeah.
Oh, good.
So happy Valentine's Day for whatever it's called.
Yeah. Thank you. You too.
Good talking to you.
Okay. Bye, Kristen.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. That was great.
That was great. What a great talk. Seriously.
Great, such great a smart, talk. Smart such a smart person.
Yeah.
So smart, yeah.
Yeah. No. I mean, I feel guilty about, you know, spending money on the flowers, but it's okay. It's all right.
I mean, you can't buy into those myths, Jack.
I didn't buy a card. You know, I didn't buy a Hallmark card.
But you bought into the myth. I'm trying to use all the things. What else could we use? You have to pay attention.
Oh, right. I can't pay attention. I have to spend attention. No, I have
put
to.
Put in. Do the work. Work.
Yes, I have to do the
work. Do the work?
Yeah,
can we
no.
say that? Hold the space. Hold the space.
I have to give my wife a salary of love. God damn it. What the fuck? This is not making any sense.
I have to spend time with the gold digger. I mean, with my partner.
What are we supposed to say? We're supposed to say you're supposed to spend, because it's like I immediately want to go to spend time. It's like I want to share time.
Yeah,
I want to share time
or span time. Isn't that what they said in Buffalo 66? Even though he's super problematic, I think so. Let's span time. Yeah,
span
also
time.
You know the word? I probably in one of the many moments I do this, I start to make a point, then I get distracted. But the Spanish word for wife or wives is handcuffs, esposas.
Really? Oh, I didn't know that.
Which is interesting because I think a lot of people who speak Spanish as a first language or, you know, two don't realize that, only because like when you learn, you don't realize it when you're not learning it as a foreign language. It's just like, that's the word for these things, and that's the word for the altar.
It's a, what the hell are those called? They're called, when one word, I can't think of it. There's a word, the word for that. An anagram, not an anagram.
But your hands are tied right now. Your tongue is tied. Your hand is tied like a pair of wives.
Homophones.
There's no place for that on this show.
No, wait, homonyms. Wait, homographs.
Homoglobe.
It's one of them.
Yeah. Well, this is we do not tolerate homophonia.
Yeah.
Homophonia.
No, no,
yeah.
No.
Yeah. Homophone. Someone said. what's ad hominem mean then? If that's the truth.
Ad hominem is when you're.
It's a personalized.
It's what a Reddit person yells at you when you're having an argument online.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. By the way, last week
I love ad hominems. By the way, you know, I did a short tour, Katie, where I went on some of the debate guys shows with YouTube people, and all I did was ad hominems at all times. I went on the guy's Destiny. This guy Destiny is awful or whatever. I hate this fucking guy, and all he wants to do is like have serious debates over the stupidest shit. And all I did was go on to insult him directly to his face over and over again. And here's my favorite thing to do, Katie, is if you go on a debate person show and then you do ad hominems on them and then they insult you back, I like to go ad hom. That's an ad hominem. What you just did was an ad hominem.
That sounds good.
I'm like, wow, you have to resort to ad hominems? You actually have to resort to ad hominems.
That's really, how do they respond?
They hate it. None of the debate guys like me, and I still get nothing but mean comments on my YouTube channel.
Well,
but who gives a
shit? That's an ad hominem, yeah.
Who cares?
Thanks so much for listening to The Katie Helper Show. Please rate and review us and subscribe to the show. And also, please consider becoming Patreon supporters at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. The Katie Helper Show is produced by Nick Palm, edited by Brad Bloom. Our intern is Maria Trujillo, and our theme song is by the band Cordoba.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up. This one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.